There is this thing. Do you realize?
Our consciousness is affected.
There is this thing.
On.
There is this thing going on.
What?
Do you realize?
Our consciousness is affected.
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news brought to you live.
Tuned into CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. This is our community news program off the hour. Today is the third day of Broadcast Against Borders. This is a week-long series of broadcasts focusing on migrant struggles in Montreal and throughout North America. This broadcast was coordinated between CKLN Radio in Toronto, CFRU Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, and of course here, CKUT Radio in Montreal. Today's program will focus on issues affecting women within the context of immigration struggles, a look at how displacement and Immigration Canada's policies affect women and how women from migrant communities are fighting back, featuring interviews with organizers on the front lines of immigrant and refugee struggles in Montreal, Canada, and throughout North America. This is CKUT's community news program off the hour. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can call us at 514-398-6788. That's 514-398-6788. You can email us at news@ckut.ca. That's news@ckut.ca. Stay tuned.
Just woke up in sunny Manchester. Yo, this is Roos Manuva on CKUT on 90.3 Montreal. Check it out.
Travel near, travel far. It's sickly bizarre. Ain't a sound that pays so. Ain't a sound that stays so. Relevant to all soldier movement. Bringing improvement. Bashment improvement. To the dub stack. High quality supply. Tunes it up.
yayo ke nikapewa nyumba mitaa ya obe tumeishi kwa raha wote niseme DJ sasa nina mimba ya miezi sita amenipa gari aina ya kwenza yote hayo na miaka mitano leo mpenzi napata weli juu yako umeoa una watoto watano uendi safari waenda kwa mkeo napo kuuliza na dada unanipenda hukutaka sema penzi kulilinda
CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. We were just listening to the sounds of Tanzania with the group Dataz. We are now going to hear a presentation on the situation facing Afghani women today as the country is surviving after it's been 5 years since the U.S.-led military invasion, and today Canada is playing a major role in Afghanistan. This is a presentation by Sonali Kolhatkar, who's the coordinator of the Afghan Women's Mission. It's an organization based in Los Angeles, and she will be addressing the situation facing Afghani women in the context of war and economic desperation, which is forcing increasingly many Afghani women and many Afghanis to flee Afghanistan in seek of asylum in Western European and North American countries. Sonali Kolhatkar on CKUT 90.3 FM.
My expertise is primarily in the United States policy in Afghanistan. I'm an American, and I have been studying U.S. policy in Afghanistan for many years now, since before 9/11, since before the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. And I've been doing solidarity work with a group of Afghan women that I'll be talking to you about today. What I'm going to do is try to address the situation of Canada and Afghanistan compared to what the U.S. has been doing, and also share with you what ordinary Afghan people want from Afghanistan, because those are the silenced voices. Those are the voices that we rarely hear in our media. I was in Afghanistan last year in February of 2005 researching for a book that I'm working on, looking at U.S. policy. Now, as I mentioned, I'm an expert of some sort in U.S. policy in Afghanistan. My expertise is looking at what the U.S. government has been doing there. But since Canadian troops are now increasing and NATO is going to be taking over from the U.S. in Afghanistan, of course, I'll be talking about that. But generally, Canada and NATO are going to be following the same trend. They're going to be following the tactic. There's nothing that NATO and Canada are doing in Afghanistan that the U.S. hasn't already been doing. And so what the U.S. has been doing in Afghanistan is a good model for us to look at if we want to know what's in store for Canadian troops. Currently, there are about 2,200 Canadian troops in Afghanistan, and that number has been increasing, and they're serving with the United States in southern Afghanistan. They're under the umbrella of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And basically, just to give you a little bit of history, after 2001, when the United States toppled the Taliban government, the United States began fighting a so-called war on terrorism to get rid of the Taliban, to get rid of Al-Qaeda. And the United Nations had a peacekeeping force, or at least it was supposed to be a peacekeeping force, called ISAF, the International Security Assistance Forces, which was supposed to do the work of keeping the peace in Afghanistan after the Taliban fell. ISAF was restricted to Kabul, however, by the United States. The United States insisted that the peacekeepers could not be in the rest of the country because it would somehow interfere with their hunt for Al-Qaeda and Taliban. And there was a political and military vacuum in Afghanistan after the Taliban left that could have been filled, instead of by the warlords and drug lords that are there now, they could have been filled temporarily, perhaps, by some sort of peacekeeping force. Given all the problems of peacekeeping forces, one can at least hope optimistically that that could have happened. But the U.S. insisted there be no peacekeepers in the rest of the country, and instead the United States followed a policy of hunting down and killing Al-Qaeda and Taliban and so-called insurgents in the rest of the countryside. And of course, Canada is going to be continuing in this legacy. There is nothing, and I think Canadians have to be very clear, there is nothing that Canadian troops will be doing in Afghanistan that is not in line with U.S. policy. Let's be really clear, the U.S. is in charge. The U.S. will dictate policy, and Canada will follow, just as the U.K. has been following, just as the rest of the NATO countries have been following. And I'll talk a little bit about NATO. So what is Canada saying that it's doing? What are Canadian generals and the Canadian military saying that they're doing? Well, we had a Canadian general very clearly spell out that Canada's here in Afghanistan to kill. Our job is to kill, right? And of course, that makes sense to some of us. The military's job is to fight wars, and generally that's what they do. And they're joining the United States in an extremely futile exercise in the so-called war on terrorism that is supposed to somehow end terrorism by killing people. Now, what has the U.S. actually been doing in Afghanistan, and has it resulted in a lowering of terrorism? Has it been resulting in a lessening of terrorism? Not at all. In fact, since 2001, you've seen attacks in Afghanistan increase. You've seen the rise of religious fundamentalism once more in Afghanistan. Afghanistan had never known suicide bombings. This was a new phenomenon in that country. However, since last December, there have been dozens of suicide bombings in Afghanistan. In fact, right around when the Canadian military began increasing its troops. And in fact, on Saturday morning, there was a suicide bomber in Kandahar that killed three people, suicide bombing that went off right by the NATO headquarters. And so if the United States policy of fighting terrorism by hunting down and killing Al-Qaeda and Taliban is not working, and if Canada is going to be following that same tactic, what's the point? Where's Canada heading? What are Canadian troops really doing there? How is it possible that Canada could improve on what the U.S. is doing? Probably not likely that Canada is supposedly somehow going to find some miraculous formula to end terrorism where the U.S. itself couldn't. And so we have to question that. Another stated goal in Afghanistan, and this is a stated goal by the Canadian military, is that we're there to win the hearts and minds of the Afghan people. We're there to somehow endear them to us by killing Afghans. We're there to make them think of us as benign, benevolent friends who are there to help them rebuild their country. And that's an extremely short-sighted approach. How do you make friends with people while you're busy killing them. And one of the tactics that NATO and Canada have been conducting in Afghanistan is something that the United States pioneered. It's an integration of military and humanitarian work, which is that instead of protecting aid workers, the military is actually doing the aid work, which is a very strange concept. It's what the United States pioneered in the form of so-called provincial reconstruction teams, or PRTs, where 5 to 50 members of the U.S. military, and now, of course, NATO and Canada, would go into a remote province or go into a city in Afghanistan and build a well or build a school for much more money than it would cost an aid organization. And they would basically tell the Afghan people, we're your friend, we're here to help. And aid workers stood back and said, wait a minute. Why are you building a well in school? Why aren't you protecting us while we are building wells in schools? What it did was it made aid workers into targets. And the Al-Qaeda and Taliban and so-called insurgent forces, and basically anybody who wasn't very happy about the presence of military, were targeting aid workers because they were then associated with the military presence. Doctors Without Borders, an organization that had been in Afghanistan for 24 years, through the worst of the worst times, left a couple of years ago. But five of their aid workers were killed, and they denounced this policy of military and humanitarian integration, which Canada is continuing on, NATO is continuing on, the concept of provincial reconstruction teams. And so this is another attempt. So on the one hand, the Canadian military is there to kill, and on the other hand, the Canadian military is there to win the hearts and minds of the Afghan people. How can it do both simultaneously? We have to ask ourselves that question.
CKUT 90.3 FM, you have been listening to the voice of Sonali Kolhatkar of the Afghan Women's Mission, speaking about the current realities in Afghanistan as the NATO troop presence in the country increases, Canada, of course, playing a strong role in maintaining that troop presence throughout the country. You are tuned into CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. This is Off the Hour. CKUT 90.3 FM, you are tuned into Off the Hour. That was Godspeed You Black Emperor, and this is broadcast Against Borders, week-long series of broadcasts on migration struggles in Montreal and throughout North America, coordinated between CKUT Radio here in Montreal, CKLN Radio in Toronto, and Cooperative Radio CFRU in Vancouver. We're now going to go to New York City, the United States. We are joined on the line by Kavita Paria, who is an organizer with DRUM, that's Desi's Rising Up and Moving. That's a group based in Queens, New York. Good afternoon, Kavita.
Good afternoon.
Thank you very much for taking the time to join us. I guess to start, today's program, well, throughout the week, actually, we've been focusing on struggles of non-status refugees and immigrants here in Canada. Throughout the last couple of months, the world's attention has turned to the United States due to the massive demonstrations that have been taking place in all the major cities across the country demanding an inclusive regularization program for non-status undocumented workers in the U.S. Today's program, we're specifically focused on women's role within this struggle for status and for regularization. So maybe can you start by giving us a bit of perspective and idea about your organization, DRUM, and how it's how it's related to this larger movement, which everybody around the world is watching today, the movement in the U.S.?
Sure. DRUM, which stands for Desi's Rising Up and Moving, Desi is a term that refers to peoples from the South Asian diaspora. DRUM has been organizing predominantly low-income, undocumented South Asians in New York City for about 6 years. We've been working with folks in the community as well as our people that are detained and facing deportation or have been affected by post-September 11th policy. And one of the things that we've really seen in the last period, if you contrast it with the post-9/11 atmosphere here in the U.S. and I'm sure in Canada, is that initially in that period there was a really intense amount of fear amongst our community in terms of coming out onto the streets, mobilizing, or even being a part of a political organization such as DRUM and other workers' organizations here in New York City. And what the last 6 months have been about has been about really breaking out of all of that fear. And we've been working for years to support our community in organizing and demanding the rights that they deserve in this country to really be able to organize despite their status, despite the exploitation that they face in the workplace or in our homes. And the last 6 months have been a real manifestation of the work that grassroots groups around the country have been doing to mobilize undocumented as well as documented immigrants. And so I think if you look at the numbers, there's been, over the last 6 months, putting all of the demonstrations together, there's been millions and millions of people around the country. On one of the National Days of Action, there were 110 actions around the country recently in New York on May 1st, which is typically International Workers' Day around the world, but it has not been honored largely in the U.S. Turned out 1 million people in New York alone, which the NYPD here is calling the largest mass demonstration in New York City's history ever. So we're really seeing a very exciting historic moment in terms of a social justice movement really coming up at the forefront in terms of a national dialogue as well as filling the streets. But also another historic piece of that is migrants really being at the lead of that struggle.
Now, can you maybe outline some of the key issues that these major demonstrations in the United States have been focusing on and how those issues are specifically related to the work of DRUM and the South Asian community that your organization works directly with?
Sure. The mass mobilizations really, I think, were triggered by the most anti-immigrant piece of legislation possibly in U.S. history, which is called the Sensenbrenner Bill, or H.R. 4437, which passed in the House in December, which would make every undocumented immigrant here a felon, and folks who work with undocumented immigrants or know of someone's status, including family members, subject to time in jail as well. And I think the mobilizations were a really strong reaction, saying that we will not, you have really oppressed our communities for years and exploited us, but we will not put up with this level of attacks on our large population in the U.S. There are 14 million undocumented immigrants. In terms of Drum, we've had a couple of campaigns for a few years that focus on demands around legalization, or what I think is often called regularization in Canada. Legalization for the 14 million undocumented immigrants that are here. But beyond legalization, also a real heavy focus for us in terms of the South Asian community, but really all migrants, is looking at enforcement and the way that the Department of Homeland Security here has really, really stepped up its efforts to crack down on migrants that are here just trying to earn a living, whether it's been through the increase in detention, a mass increase in deportation, to I think the extent that 1 million people have been deported from the U.S. in the last 10 years. On any given day, 30,000 to 40,000 people are in prisons, immigrant detention centers all around the country, a large percentage of those being South Asian, a large percentage of those detention centers being in the New York, New Jersey area, as well as a major increase at the community level of collaboration between local police, state police, and Homeland Security, so collaborative efforts that bring local police into people's homes to arrest, detain, and deport our community members who are guilty of nothing but, besides not having their papers here. And so that's the enforcement piece has really been the center of our work, because it has had a major impact on our community. After September 11th, the atmosphere dramatically changed, and an intense amount of racial and religious profiling came down on the South Asian Arab and Muslim communities, as I believe has been the case in Canada as well. And I think that in terms of all our work, if we talk about North American work, that there's been a lot of similarities and trends in terms of government practice, as well as collaboration between the U.S. and Canadian governments.
Now, can you maybe, you talked about 1 million deportations. That's an unimaginable number, really. And you talked also about the effects of these enforcement policies on immigrant and refugee communities, specifically the South Asian, Arab, and Muslim communities in the United States. But today we're trying to focus on the effects of these policies on women within these communities, and specifically how women within these communities are taking a lead role in organizing and fighting back against these policies in support of, you know, the attempts for regularization and all the struggles that are included within this movement that you talked about. So can you maybe address this topic?
Sure. At Drum in particular, we have centralized and focused building the leadership of women in directing our work, in directing our campaigns, in developing the demands, and being really at the forefront of building this movement within our communities. And one particular reason for that is that women in particular in our communities have not been been able to access those spaces enough, and I think, you know, that goes for many of our communities. And we've really been able to do that, one, because of our focus on it, but two, because women in most migrant communities often bear the brunt of living with these types of repressive immigration policies that we've been talking about. If I think just in the last couple of years of Drum's history, many of our leaders have been women whose fathers have been deported, whose husbands have been deported and are now left in the U.S. bringing up their children, raising their families and providing income on their own, fighting their partners or their brothers' deportation cases or detention cases from the outside, really basically bearing the brunt of all of these policies in many, many ways. And so it's been very exciting and powerful to know that it is women that are at the forefront of this historical struggle for human rights, for social justice in the U.S., but I think it also speaks to a global trend of women being at the forefront.
Now, finally, can you maybe talk about some of the human impacts of these policies? We heard the term, and still an unbelievable number, 1 million deportations from the United States, and also in counter to that, the hundreds of thousands, millions of people that have been demonstrating across the U.S. These past couple of months. But given that your organization, Drum, works on a ground level with many community members, specifically within the South Asian community of New York City, can you talk about how these immigration laws affect people that you've worked with? Maybe perhaps paint a bit of a human picture of how these laws affect families and people that you work with as an organization.
Sure. I'll just maybe go through a couple of recent cases. One about a year and a half ago of a Bangladeshi member of ours who had visited the Department of Motor Vehicles here because she received a letter to verify status on her, in terms of her driver's license, to verify her social security number, what's called a social insurance number in Canada. She went into the DMV. They told her there were no problems. A couple of days later, the Department of Homeland Security showed up at her house at 5 in the morning with her picture from the Department of Motor Vehicles and detained and deported her eventually. We worked on that case and there were no options for her. She had two small children, a 1.5-year-old and a 4-year-old who were both U.S. citizens, had never been to Bangladesh, and were, when she was deported, were also taken back to Bangladesh so that they could be with their mother. That's one example of how these policies come down. In her particular case, she had a valid asylum case that had been botched by several poor immigration attorneys who did not do enough on her case and had allowed deportation orders against her to come through. And her options were to either wait in detention to fight her case for 2, maybe 4 years, without any options of being released from detention while she waited on her case, which is very, very common that folks wait in detention centers for up to, I've heard, 6, 7 years waiting for their cases to work through the court system. Another example is a case of a green card holder, a legal permanent resident who had a couple of minor crimes, jumping the turnstile at a subway and some other minor crime, and was subject to deportation because of those two crimes, hadn't been back to his home country for 15 years, had been in the U.S. since he was 10 years old, and didn't know how to speak the language and was deported back to South Asia. Another example is two 16-year-old Muslim sisters who were high school students and had been part of some Muslim political discussion circles and who we assume were being surveilled by the FBI. Eventually, they were detained, arrested from their homes by the FBI and detained for several months at the age of 16, a Bangladeshi sister and a Ghanaian sister. One of them has since been released, and the other one has since been deported back to Bangladesh, a country she hasn't lived in since she was about 2 years old. And on those cases, you know, the combination of the FBI's ability to detain individuals if they're suspected of any sort of terrorist activity, and that's those were trumped up false charges by the FBI. They were held under secret evidence so that the public was not able to assess whether those cases were legitimate in any way, which they were not, and then were left with very little options in terms of legalization for themselves and options to stay in the country where they've been since they were small children. You know, I could rattle off so many cases. It's really a daily assault on immigrants in this country.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to join us today and to shed some light on the work of your organization, DRUM, and the growing civil rights movement in the United States for the rights of immigrants.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good luck with your work.
Have a nice day. We've been speaking with Kavita Parawi, who is an organizer with DRUM. That's Desi's Rising Up and Moving. That's a community-based organization based in Queens, New York. She was speaking about the situation facing non-status and immigrant communities in the United States after September 11th. Today you were tuned into Off the Hour, and this is part three of a week-long series of special broadcasts on CKUT between 5 and 6 p.m. Called Broadcasts Against Borders. This series is taking place in collaboration between CKUT Radio and in Montreal, of course, CKLN Radio in Toronto, and CFRU Cooperative Radio in Vancouver. So do stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment.
CKUT, CKLN, and Co-op Radio present Broadcasting Against Borders, a national radio broadcast from May 22nd to 26th, in the lead-up to the Cross Canada Day of Action Status for All on May 27th. Tune in to hear reports, discussions, and interviews on the state of migration in Canada. Powerful stories from the front lines of struggle as immigrants and refugees fight for dignity and the right to stay. On CKUT, tune in to Off the Hour, 5 to 6 p.m., from May 22nd to 26th. Each day, we will bring you coverage from this broadcast. And don't forget the Status for All Day of Action, coast to coast, on May 27th. For more information, call 514-398-6788. Email news@ckut.ca or visit www.solidarityacrossborders.org. No one is illegal.
The media is a story that you tell.
You are the media. You then are the media.
You now are the media. Are the media.
Find out who you are at CKUT 90.3 FM.
Dissent through sound.
Dissent through sound.
Looking for media and its reflection.
Join us for general orientation every third Thursday, 12, 3, and 6 p.m.
3647 University, CKUT 90.3 FM.
Oh, they're very shrewd. I must say, they're really quite remarkable in their ability to use the media.
Mean and happy, 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 mean and happy. happy, mean and happy, mean and happy, mean and happy, انت الهابي. مين الهابي؟ انا الهابي. كيف الهابي وانا عايش ببلادي؟ مين الهابي؟ انت الهابي. ماكلني وانا عايش ببلادي، قتلني زي ما قتلت اجدادي.
اجل القانون
على الفاضي، ما انت يا عدو بتلعب دور الشاهد، المحامي والقاضي، علي قاضي، نهايتي بادي. حلمك انقل فوق ما احنا آلية، حلمك لآلية تصير بالمقابر اكترية. ديمقراطية
والله انكم ناسية،
من كثر ما اغتصبتوا النفس العربية.
حبلت ولدت
ولد اسمه عملية انفجارية، وهنا ديت ترهبية. يعني ضربتني وبكيت، سبعتني واشتكيت لما ذكرتك انك بديت،
نطيت وحكيت.
ما انتو بتخلوا ولاد صغار يرموا حجار، من هم مش اهل يدبوهم بالدار. ايش كنو نسيت انو ساحب ضب الاهل تحت الحجار، وقال لا لما وجع الفار بتناديني ارهابي.
مين ارهابي؟ انا ارهابي. كيف ارهابي وانا عايش في بلادي؟ مين ارهابي؟ انت ارهابي. ماكلني وانا عايش في بلادي.
ليش ارهابي؟ عشان دمي مش هادي، حامي عشان رافع راسي وارض بلادي. قتلوا حبايبي انا لحالي، اهلي تشردوا راح اضلي انادي. انا مش ضد السلام، السلام ضدي، علي بده يهدي، تراثي بده يمحي. واللي بيحكي كلمة بيشد ورا حمة بيكون زلمة تعملوا منه رمة. ومين انتو لسه امتى خبرتو؟ اطلوا قديش قتلتوا وقديش قدمتوا. امياتنا بيبكوا، ابياتنا بيشكوا، اراضينا بيخطفوا. انا بقولكم مين انتو؟ انتو خبرتو بدلا، احنا كبرنا فقر، من كبر فوسع ومن كبر شحر. صار في داعي عملتو منه اجرامي، وانت يا ارهابي بتناديني ارهابي.
مين ارهابي؟ انا ارهابي. كيف ارهابي وانا عايش ببلادي؟ مين ارهابي؟ انت ارهابي. ماكلني وانا عايش ببلادي. امتى ببطل ارهابي؟ لما تضربني كف واديك خد تاني. كيف تتوقع مني اشكر الاذاني؟ تعرف ايش انت؟ قولي كيف ايدك ياني؟ راكع ركبي وايدي مربطات، عيون بالارض وجثث مدتتات، بيوت مهدومه، عائلات مشردات، اطفال يتيمه، حريه في كلبشات. انت عمر، انت اردن، احنا بنقبر، ما علينا بنصبر، وجعنا بنستر. اهم شيء انك تحس بامان، اتريح وسيب لنا الالام. ما هو دمنا دم كلاب؟ حتى لا، لما الكلب يموت في الرفق بالحيوان، يعني دمنا ارخص من دم الكلاب. لا دمي غالي، روح ادافع حالي لو تناديني ارهابي.
مين ارهابي؟ 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 انت ارهابي.
CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. You're listening to the hip-hop group Damn. We are joined now on the phone by Harsha Walia, who is an organizer with No One Is Illegal in Vancouver, and also the Status Coalition. Good afternoon, Harsha.
Hey, Christoph.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So I guess to start, there's a National Day of Action taking place this Saturday here in Canada. This Day of Action is taking place in the shadow of massive demonstrations that we saw in the United States over the last couple of months, demonstrations relating also to the issue of non-status people and the demand for, in the U.S. they call it legalization, in Canada, regularization. There's a demonstration in Vancouver, there's one in Montreal, also one in Toronto. So can you maybe talk about this upcoming National Day of Action? Why is it being organized? What are the key issues that are going to be addressed?
Yeah, absolutely. The National Day of Action is for status for all, but also more broadly for immigrant rights. And one of the key issues is obviously regularization, which is, as you mentioned, also known as legalization, particularly in the context of the U.S. and in more bureaucratic terms, quote-unquote amnesty. But what we're calling for is status for all, which is a very transformative and essentially quite radical demand, which basically affirms that everyone in Canada should have full permanent residency status here in Canada, whether they're here for 2 months, whether they're here for 10 years, whether they're non-status, whether they're temporary migrant workers, no matter what anyone's current legal status is, no matter what their situation is, whether they're on social assistance or they're elders or they're single mothers, everyone should have the right to status in Canada. And this is a basic issue of self-determination and justice for those who migrate. But also the broader issues are around for immigrant, as I was mentioning, is also for immigrant justice in the post 9/11 climate. But historically, as well, immigrants continue to live as second class, hyphenated, citizens in Canada and continue to occupy a space in Canada where they continue to be demonized. And we see that historically through various, various acts of exclusion, all the way from the Kamagatamaru incident, where boats of South Asians were not allowed on the shores of Vancouver, BC, to the Chinese head tax, to the Japanese internment, where those who were Japanese-Canadian were thought to be quote-unquote enemy alien and profiled and targeted. So our march is to highlight regularization, which affects certain parts of our communities, but also the much, much broader issue of nationalization and citizenship in Canada. And so citizenship is not just an issue of papers, because, you know, there are many, many people in our communities who are citizens or who have legal status. For example, the men who are being held on security certificates technically have status in Canada, but are continuing to be targeted and profiled because they happen to be racialized minorities. So we're trying to highlight all of these different issues.
Now, can you maybe describe for us, in terms of non-status in Canada, we've heard various estimates in terms of numbers, 200,000, 300,000.
To 500,000 on CBC recently.
So maybe can you describe for us what that means? Your organization, known as Illegal, which also has chapters in Toronto and Montreal, has worked directly with non-status people and organizing these various demonstrations and public campaigns around these issues. So can you maybe describe for people what the non-status communities in Canada's major cities face in terms of day-to-day life? What does living without papers in Canada mean for an individual?
Yeah, and that's obviously unimaginable for most people in Canada, because pretty much everything that people with papers take for granted in Canada, those without status have no access to. One of the most obvious things in living without status is constant anxiety and fear and stress that people cannot even imagine. The fear of every day waking up, every day going to bed with the feeling that at any time someone could be at your door. Every time you cross the street, someone could ask you for your status. Every time your children are in school, they can be nabbed. That kind of fear, no one lives in. That deep-rooted sense of instability and insecurity is something that no one other than the non-status population experience every single day. In the workplace, it means being exploited because your employer knows, potentially knows that you are non-status. It means having no rights to unionize, not being able to get minimum wage. It means not being able to access health care because you don't have a care card. It means if you don't have your SIN number or your work permit is expired, again, further exploitation. People not wanting to access social services, so people are pretty much forced to work. They're already working minimum wage jobs, having to work two or three or four of them because they can't access any other social services. So it's a complete underclass life, complete life of invisibility below the radar. But these are people that we come in contact with every single day. These are people who work in the service industry, work in the garment industry, work as janitors, pumping gas, as nannies. But they're invisible to us, but because their life has deliberately been invisibilized. But we're in contact with the non-status community every single day. In major cities of Canada, it's impossible for a Canadian to go about their daily life without coming into contact with a non-status community. Mm-hmm. But one of the greatest myths, of course, and challenges that we have to address is this idea constantly that people believing that the non-status community are quote-unquote criminals or terrorists because they've come illegally and they're trying to evade the law and they have something to hide. And that's factually not true at all, because most people who are non-status are people who have overstayed deportation orders and had originally made refugee claims. So most non-status actually entered Canada legally, made a claim at the border or made a claim at some office. So it's also the way that public consciousness tries to construct and continue to racialize and demonize non-status people, and again try to create this fear and paranoia of the non-status community, who are our neighbors, our friends, our families, that we know and come in contact with every single day.
Now, this Saturday, there's demonstrations being planned across the country. Can you maybe talk about these demonstrations? What are you expecting in Vancouver, and what are you expecting nationally?
In terms of numbers, I won't say any because I'm actually not entirely sure, but...
I mean, the key issues that will be addressed.
Yeah, I mean, as we said earlier, the key issue is, one of the key issues is regularization, but there are many, many other issues that are affecting, I mean, the Vancouver March, for example, is marching for immigrant rights as well as status for all, because immigrants continue to face issues such as deep, deep poverty. Immigrant women in Canada, for example, face a poverty rate in Toronto. There was a report that came out 2 years ago that recent immigrant women in Canada have a poverty rate of 80% compared to the normal poverty rate for quote-unquote Canadians, which is approximately 12%. In BC, the training wage, which is basically training wage is approximately $6 under minimum wage, is used to hire immigrant women. Because the idea of a training wage is that you are quote-unquote untrained, which is a direct result of Immigration Canada's process of de-skilling and not accrediting immigrant workers. So there's so many issues that are related not only to status, but related to broader issues, social issues of poverty and criminalization and racial profiling and racialization and sexism that immigrant communities deal with every single day that we're also trying to highlight.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to join us today.
Thanks, Krista.
We've been speaking with Harsha Walia, who's an organizer with No One Is Illegal in Vancouver, one of the groups that is assisting in coordinating a National Day of Actions, which is taking place this Saturday between Canada's major cities demanding status for all non-status immigrants. We're now going to go to an interview with Dolores Chu, who's one of the board members of the South Asian Women's Community Center here in Montreal. This is an interview on issues relating to non-status immigrants and non-status South Asians and the realities faced specifically by non-status South Asian women. This interview was produced by Kathy Inouye of CKUT Radio.
Okay, so today I'm on the phone with Dolores Chu. Is that how you pronounce your last name?
Yes.
Dolores? Okay.
Perfect.
Dolores, can you tell us a little bit about what you do?
Well, I'm a founding member of the South Asian Women's Community Center, which is a service support and advocacy organization for South Asian women and their families in the Greater Montreal area. But even though we identify ourselves as a South Asian organization working within this particular community, our services are open to anybody who comes to us. We've been around for 25 years. In fact, this is our 25th anniversary. And from get-go, we've dealt with all kinds of needs that the community faces, and always, you know, issues of migration and refuge. And, of course, it also sort of changes depending on what's going around in other places in the world, in terms of, you know, sometimes we've had an influx of people from Bangladesh or Sri Lanka, more recently Afghanistan, etc.
And what kind of status do most of the people have that you see? How does that impact on their lives?
Well, very often, you know, people come to the South Asian Women's Center when they're fairly new to the city, and they're usually referred to us. For example, you know, there are flyers about our organization in, say, Quebec immigration centers or CLSCs. So very often people will get referred to us when they are new arrivals. And because we can speak, you know, many South Asian languages, this becomes very, very useful. But sometimes we also get people who have been here for quite a while, but because the needs are so perhaps culturally specific, or even if they have been here for a long time, they may not have yet got to know what is out there. When they do need certain kinds of services, they end up coming to us.
Have the changes in the government over the years impacted on the lives of the people that you see come into you, the kinds of stories they tell?
Well, definitely, you know, there have always been issues, particularly with people who either are here as immigrants and are trying to bring over family members, either parents or spouses. There have been, you know, a lot of delays, and sometimes we've had to assist. We've been part of kind of a campaign at one time to hasten the family reunification process. And then particularly after 9/11, the whole, you know, racial profiling, and since we deal with families from places like Bangladesh and Pakistan, where you have, you know, large Muslim majority populations, the kind of racial profiling, the Islamophobia has caused a lot of concern and anxiety in communities that are already under, you know, feel very, very insecure because their status is unsure. You know, sometimes they are also dealt with in sort of illegal, semi-legal ways by traffickers. So very often when we meet them, they're already under a lot of stress. And, you know, the security certificates and things have definitely not helped the criminalization. We found there's been a lower level of tolerance and acceptance. You know, we're often dealing with cases where people are about to be deported. And sometimes we have been able to help simply in getting their cases relooked at, because perhaps the first time they had an interpreter who wasn't interpreting what they were saying accurately. And in a few cases, we have been fortunate in helping. But there are many people also who are being deported. So there has been a change in terms of the federal government's introduction of security certificates and a general climate of suspicion and fear since 9/11.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
And you have been listening to CKUT's community news program Off the Hour. Today's broadcast was part of a week-long series of broadcasts in collaboration with CFRU Cooperative Radio in Vancouver and CKLN Radio in Toronto, being called Broadcast Against Borders. If you'd like any more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you'd like to get involved or support news at CKUT, you can contact the Community News Department at 514-398-6788. That's 514-398-6788. Our email is news@ckut.ca. That's news@ckut.ca. You can also get more information relating to the special programming this week, Broadcast Against Borders, at the website of Solidarity Across Borders. They are online at solidarityacrossborders.org. Stay tuned for Upstage, which is coming up next.